The following program is for our audience of blind and print impaired listeners from the North Carolina Reading Service. And from the distinctive theme music, which we often hear, it's Indie Week, read by John Federson. This issue, dated January. What is the issue? Oh, it's out of date here. The 26th, January 26th of 2023. It lasts 58 minutes, one of which I've wasted already. So let's get right down to it. The online version of Indie Week, IndieWeek.com, has many, many articles which are not printed in the print edition, and I'm going to start with some of them, the first of which regards the vandalism at the Moore County power substations on December 3rd. North Carolina Representative Ben Moss, Jr. has introduced legislation directly responding to a possible terrorist attack on two Duke Energy substations last December, as well as a recent shooting incident at a substation in Thomasville, Randolph County. Someone used high-powered rifles to shoot up the Moore County substations on December 3, cutting off electricity for more than 40,000 people for several days. SBI and FBI are investigating, but have not named a suspect. Moss is a Republican representing Moore and Richmond counties. Although its language is still skeletal, the Energy Security Act would provide 24-hour security systems at power substations against vandalism and other security threats. Representative Terry Brown, Jr., a Mecklenburg Democrat, sits on the House Energy and Public Utilities Committee. He told Policy Watch, where this article was first printed, the bill will eventually lay out whether the security would take the form of cameras, guards, on-site security, or a mix. And there are hundreds of Duke Energy substations throughout North Carolina. It's still unclear who would pay for the security and the cost. Brown said he spoke with Duke representatives about the financial aspects of the bill, and he said it's still in the early stages. But I think we should work with Duke, that it needs to be some kind of collaboration between Duke and the states. There have been at least 15 similar attacks on energy infrastructure elsewhere, leading federal investigators to believe that at least some of the incidents are linked and the work of extremists, including neo-Nazi groups, who want to destabilize the government and society in general. Two men have been charged in connection with the December 25th incident in Washington State. Other substations have been damaged in Oregon, South Carolina, and Nevada. Next, from Indie Week Online, Eli Lilly will add 100 jobs at RTP manufacturing facility. Company officials estimate about 90% of those jobs will be entry-level positions that pay an average wage of about $56,000 plus benefits. And, of course, we've been hearing about a lot of big tech companies cutting major sections of their employment, but this doesn't involve that. It's a pharmaceutical giant, Eli Lilly. They will invest $400 million to expand its facility at Research Triangle Park and create 100 new jobs over the next 5 years. It's also announced an aspirational goal of committing $35 million in investments to businesses owned by people of color and women, according to a county press release made public on Wednesday. Company officials estimate that about 90% of the jobs will be entry-level that pay an average wage of $56,000 plus benefits. The company says most of those jobs will be filled by applicants who have earned a BioWork certificate from Durham Tech or have earned a high school diploma. The Mammoth Project is being supported by a 10-year performance agreement with Durham County, totaling up to $5 million that was approved by county commissioners on Tuesday during a regularly scheduled meeting. The payments will, quote, follow performance verification by county officials who will determine if those promised jobs, investment, and community benefits targets were achieved. Brenda Howerton, chair of the County Board of Commissioners, said in this press release, "We are very excited about Lilly's robust expansion here in Durham County and what it means for the Triangle region. Howerton added that over the 2 years the company has been at RTP, Eli Lilly, quote, has demonstrated the corporate model that we aim to encourage through workforce partnerships with local schools and community college, investments in diverse vendors, and a commitment to environmental responsibility. By providing paid internships and apprenticeships, they will help prepare students for the project's entry-level jobs that offer a career pathway. Wednesday's press release indicates initial production at RTP will begin this year, with preparations that are ongoing for inspections by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The new jobs can't come soon enough to address the growing need for jobs that pay a living wage for a great many high school graduates who end up struggling to make ends meet while working in low-paying, service-oriented jobs. Andrew Miracle, Durham County's Economic Development Director, said in the release, "When we revised our business recruitment policy 3 years ago, this is exactly the project we hoped to recruit." He noted, "With most of the new jobs only requiring a BioE work certificate from Durham Tech or high school education, Lilly has consistently demonstrated their commitment to workforce development by raising industry awareness and offering training opportunities investment. We are excited to see this significant investment move forward." Governor Cooper also weighed in positively on the announcements. With its main offices in Indianapolis, Lilly's expansion at RTP will include, quote, device assembly and packaging capacity to support an increased demand for Lilly's incretin products that treat diabetes. Lilly officials say the company has introduced 18 new medicines since 2014 to make life better for people living with diseases like diabetes and cancer, and intends to introduce several new medicines this year. Since arriving in North Carolina in 2020, Lilly has earmarked about $4 billion to create new manufacturing facilities in the state, including $1.7 billion for the development and expansion of this RTP site. Edgardo Hernandez, Lilly's executive vice president, who presides over its manufacturing operations, said the company this year is focused on finding innovative solutions to meet a growing demand for their medications. Quote, "Expanding our operations at RTP will accelerate the rate at which we can produce medicines that patients can rely on to address serious health challenges like diabetes." He added that expansion of the manufacturing facilities at RTP is key to ensuring even more patients will have access to medicines they need in the future. And another Indie Week article that's not in the print edition. RDU touts new biometric technology now offered to passengers. Officials at Raleigh-Durham International Airport announced the launch of this new technology that will allow its passengers to verify their identity with their eyes or fingers. RDU officials have described this as a means of bringing a frictionless and predictable travel experience to the Research Triangle region. They have partnered with Clear, a privately owned company that uses biometric identity verification technology to screen airport passengers. This replaces the need for travelers to take out their wallet and driver's license, according to an RDU press release made public yesterday. Officials say the identity technology will create 44 jobs at RDU and generate about $2.6 million annually to the local economy. Michael Languth, President and Chief Executive Officer of RDU Authority, stated, "RDU is proud to partner with Clear to provide travelers another option to expedite security screening process. RDU's commitment to leveraging technology to provide our guests with a world-class experience makes Clear an excellent fit." Clear's website notes that the U.S. Travel Safety Administration PreCheck is a federal program that identifies travelers deemed low risk through a security threat assessment. Passengers approved for TSA PreCheck are allowed to pass through an expedited security screening at U.S. airports nationwide with no need to remove shoes, laptops, 311 liquids, belts, or light jackets. By comparison, CLEAR members can, quote, step right up to a CLEAR pod and verify their identity through their eyes or fingerprint instead of waiting to show their government-issued photo ID. Many of our members find those two services complement each other, providing the quickest, surest route through the airport. Of course, a goodly number of folks, sans TSA PreCheck status, and even with a CLEAR membership, will have to continue nearly disrobing at RDU security checkpoints that are monitored by TSA employees, said Crystal Feldman, an RDU spokeswoman. Still, RDU passengers who are CLEAR members are directed to dedicated lanes where there's a shorter wait to have their identity verified with this technology. It costs about $16 a month to become a member of CLEAR Plus. This allows the travelers access to the company's expedited verification lanes. After the IDs are verified through eye and finger technology, quote, a CLEAR ambassador escorts members through the dedicated lane and directly to physical security, saving them time waiting in line at the security checkpoint. According to Wednesday's release, CLEAR was founded in 2010 and now has more than 14 million members, hundreds of partners around the world who use that identity platform at the airport, stadium, or right on the phone. The release did not make it clear if RDU is the 50th airport or globally to adopt the technology. Now, Jasmine Gallup from Raleigh. Daryl Williams died last week after being tased multiple times by Raleigh police officers, according to a preliminary report. The five-day report released by Raleigh police recounts a tragic incident in which officers repeatedly tried to subdue Williams, faced resistance, and ultimately turned to their tasers to overpower and handcuff him. It also mirrors dozens of stories black residents have about encounters with police in which they were minding their own business, only to be suddenly confronted by officers for little or no reason. At one point, officers tased Williams, 32, twice in less than a minute, placing their tasers on the skin of his body. Williams was heard on a body-worn camera saying, "I have heart problems," the report stated. In a press conference Tuesday, Emancipate NC leaders, joined by Williams' mother, Sonia, condemned the Raleigh Police Department for the incident, calling that police report propaganda and saying it unfairly vilifies Williams. Dawn Blagrove, executive director of Emancipate North Carolina, quotes, "This report is designed to malign the victim, to malign the murder victim. It doesn't matter what they found in his car. What matters is that on that night he was bothering no one. He was minding his own business." What happened? Williams was arrested on January 17th during a late-night patrol of the 800 block of Rock Quarry Road, a location with, quote, a history of repeat calls for service for drugs, weapons, and other criminal violations, the police report stated. During the patrol, two officers found Williams and another person in Williams' black Mercedes, which was parked in front of a Supreme sweepstakes parlor. As Williams opened the passenger side door, officers saw, quote, an open container of alcohol and marijuana in the car. Upon detaining and searching Williams, officers found, quote, a folded dollar bill in Mr. Williams' pocket containing a white powdery substance consistent with the appearance of cocaine. The RPD has not yet released confirmation that the substance was, in fact, cocaine. As two more police officers arrived on the scene, police attempted to arrest Williams, but he became combative and resistant. The report stated, officers told Williams to place his hands behind his back and warned him, "Stop or you are going to get tased." According to the report, Williams tried to flee the scene on foot before officers caught up with him. Another two officers then arrived and assisted in an effort to arrest Williams. In the course of the entire confrontation, Williams was tased three times, twice by Robinson and once by the other officer. He was handcuffed around 2 a.m. and placed in an RPD vehicle in the recovery position. Shortly afterwards, Williams stopped breathing and his heart stopped beating. RPD officers called EMS at 2:02 a.m. as they're required to do after using a taser, and again at 2:06 a.m. after officers started CPR. Williams was later pronounced dead at 3:01 a.m. after being transported to a local hospital, despite police and EMS attempting CPR and other resuscitation measures. During Tuesday's news conference, Blake Grove and local activist Kerwin Pittman each compared this preventative policing, or proactive patrolling, to stop and frisk, a practice that disproportionately targets Black Americans. Emancipate NC argues that proactive patrolling is a remnant of the Jim Crow era, and it encourages, quote, harassing Black people for simply being in their own communities. Proactive patrolling is racial profiling of marginalized communities, added Pittman, saying it mostly happens in Southeast Raleigh, which is majority Black. It's finding an excuse when there is no excuse, other than to stop minorities. Nothing more. The six officers involved in that incident have been placed on administrative leave, which typically includes pay, per Raleigh police policy. The confrontation was captured by body-worn cameras as well as dash cameras, which the department plans to release. And officials are conducting an autopsy to determine the official cause of Williams' death. Next, by Lynn Bonner from North Carolina Policy Watch. An obstetrician-gynecologist with a practice in Orange County is suing in federal court over restrictions that the state imposes on providing an abortion pill. State requirements for giving patients a drug called mifepristone, go beyond what the Food and Drug Administration requires. The extra restrictions the state imposes were considered and rejected by the FDA, the lawsuit says, and they're not needed to ensure safety. Dr. Amy Bryant, plaintiff in the lawsuit, said in a statement, as a physician, my number one priority is the health and well-being of my patients. We know from years of research and use that medication abortion is safe and effective. There's no medical reason for politicians to interfere or restrict access to it, or for states to force doctors to comply with mandates not supported by medicine or science. These burdensome restrictions on medication abortion force physicians to deal with unnecessary restrictions on patient care and on the health care system. North Carolina controls include, quote, restrictions that FDA has specifically rejected that upset the carefully balanced regulatory scheme established by federal law, says the lawsuit. It was filed in federal court Wednesday and names State Attorney General Josh Stein, members of the NC Medical Board, State Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Cody Kinsley, and Jeff Neiman, the district attorney in Orange and Chatham counties, as defendants in their official capacities. A spokeswoman for Stein's office said in an email the office is reviewing the complaint. A spokeswoman for the NC Medical Board said in an email it was aware of the lawsuit, but she would not comment. The FDA first approved mifepristone as an abortion method in 2000, and now medication abortions account for more than half the abortions in the United States, according to the Guttmacher Institute. Mifepristone is the first of two medications taken to induce abortion. Abortion with pills is approved for use in pregnancies through 10 weeks. North Carolina requires in-person appointments with doctors with patients taking mifepristone while doctors are present. The pill can be provided only in a specific type of medical facility after state-mandated counseling, a 72-hour waiting period, and in some cases, after an ultrasound. The FDA allows telehealth appointments and this year began to allow certain pharmacies to dispense the medication. Patients can take the pill at home if they want. The certified providers prescribing the medication don't have to be doctors under FDA rules, and the FDA does not require a waiting period. So the lawsuit says that the extra state restrictions impose significant costs and burdens on Bryant and her patients. She would be able to see more patients and at a lower cost, but for these restrictions. And since timing is important when taking these pills, the extra time the state requires might push some patients beyond the time window allowed for mifepristone use, requiring procedures that are more expensive and more involved. The North Carolina lawsuit adds to the focus on abortion pills after the U.S. Supreme Court ended the constitutional right to abortion. An abortion pill manufacturer filed a federal lawsuit Wednesday in West Virginia challenging a state ban, the New York Times reported. Anti-abortion health care groups are challenging this FDA approval of mifepristone in a federal lawsuit, which has filed late last year. Now, back to January the 20th. I may or may not have read this last time. I don't think I did, though. Another article by Tomasi McDonald. Fidelity launches $250 million initiative to help black and brown students graduate college. The Triangle has been selected as one of three regions where the pilot program will start, along with Boston and Dallas. This is a multi-trillion dollar investment firm, Fidelity Investments. They launched a financial aid program to help black and Latinx students complete their education. On Tuesday, one day after the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, Fidelity made public the company's Invest in My Education, ME, a program that has committed $250 million with a goal of reaching up to 50,000 students. This is from a company press release. And the Triangle has been selected where the pilot program, along with Boston and Dallas. In 2020, soon after the murders of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery, Fidelity's chair and chief executive officer, Abby Johnson, said while, quote, grieving over racial violence and discrimination, it was imperative to look forward to how we can make a difference, both at Fidelity and in local communities. The company has been putting its money and resources toward that end in the years since. In 2021, the firm, founded in 1930 and now with over $10 trillion in assets, started Fidelity Financial Forward. That's a free financial literacy resource for parents, teachers, and K-12 students in underserved communities. According to its website, the firm has conducted financial literacy workshops in partnership with the NAACP, 100 Black Men, Black Girls Code, the Association of Latino Professionals for America, and other groups dedicated to removing barriers to economic opportunity. The company is also a member of the Take on Race Coalition, quote, which helped put 1 million electronic devices with reliable connectivity and tech support in the hands of students of color in the midst of the COVID pandemic, according to its website. In its press release this week, Fidelity officials say that the ME program will rely on a holistic approach that combines scholarships, individual support, mentoring, and community grants to facilitate economic mobility for Black and Latinx students. Officials say the success of the program will be, quote, measured through students' college completion rates, their capacity to graduate without student debt, and their ability to secure good-paying jobs that facilitate greater economic mobility and financially firm futures. The company points to research and data that shows only 21% of Black and 32% of Latinx students who start college graduate within 4 years, 21% compared to 45% of white students. The release states, this disruption has long-term financial implications. The median income earnings of people with a bachelor's degree were 63% higher than the earnings of those whose highest educational level was the completion of high school. Moreover, associate degrees are also linked to greater earnings, providing a 20% boost over the median earnings of those with a high school education. Fidelity also found that Black students are 114% less likely to graduate from college in 4 years versus their white counterparts, and that black and brown students accrue $25,000 more in college debt than white students. The ME initiative will, quote, focus on financial well-being, bringing together scholarships, mentoring, student success, and education expertise, as well as experienced nonprofit partners to improve the long-term outcomes of thousands of black, Latinx, and underserved students, says the release. Fidelity officials describe the initiative as a long-term, personalized approach to improve post-graduation outcomes for black, Latinx, and other historically underserved students. Supporting the opportunity for economic mobility and a foundation to build a path toward generational wealth. The company has partnered with nonprofits, including the United Negro College Fund, UNCF, to address what they call the three key components of this initiative. Quote, UNCF's North Star is to increase the total annual number of underrepresented graduates by focusing on activities that ensure more students are college ready, enroll in college, and persist to graduation, said Michael Lomax, who's the president and CEO of UNCF. Quote, the combination of our community knowledge and Fidelity's expertise in financial wellness will make a significant impact on the lives of these students. The ME initiative will provide individual scholarships to help students in underserved communities overcome financial barriers to success and graduate debt-free from a two-year college, four-year college, or certificate program, along with, quote, a suite of ongoing support, including mentorship by Fidelity Associates, intern and apprenticeship guidance, and financial education programming. The initiative will also make available retention and completion grants, quote, to help institutions assist students who are close to completion and in danger of dropping out due to unpaid tuition and academic fee balances. It will provide grants for nonprofits that focus on improving graduation for thousands of underserved high school and college students, according to the release. The firm is also engaged in an ongoing goal to strengthen its commitment to diversity and inclusion at every level within its own organization, and maintaining its focus on delivering relevant products and services to its increasingly diverse customers, officials stated in the press release. And this adds the article, for more information about the Invest in My Education program, contact this, Invest in My Education, that's one word, at fmr.com. Well, now the rustling of paper should tell you I'm moving to the print edition of Indie Week, which was printed and available yesterday. The cover story shows a trunk of a large tree, and the article is titled Vanishing Trees, and it's by Jasmine Gallup. Matt Stanwyck, who lives in a townhome community in North Raleigh with his wife, was walking his dog, River, through the neighborhood on a rare sunny day in mid-January when he noticed there weren't as many trees as there used to be. Where dozens of oak trees once stood in small pockets around townhomes, there were now just scattered saplings, dogwoods, and pines standing among the many stumps hidden by fallen leaves. In some areas, about a quarter of the trees had been chopped down. In others, up to half the trees were gone, according to Stanwyck. For the renters of homes located in Edwards Mill townhomes and apartments, the neighborhood is a rare pocket of serenity in the ever-changing, ever-growing North Raleigh. At least, it used to be. Since January 12th, dozens of trees in this quiet, secluded community have been cut down, leaving wood chips scattered across the parking lot as tree limbs and trunks sliced into pieces on the side of the road. Stanwyck, who's lived in Edwards Mill for about a year, knew crews had been at work during tree trimming and removal. The buzz and rattle of chainsaws and wood chippers was almost nonstop for at least a week, he says. But he, like many of the residents, had no idea why the trees were coming down when work first started. He says, we assumed they were just kind of doing cleanup, but it was pretty obvious that it was more than that with as much as they were cutting. It wasn't until probably a few days in that we received an email from management. Even that email was frustrating, Stanwyck says, because it didn't fully explain why the trees were coming down, but simply threatened to tow cars that were in construction zones. Another email from the new management company, ZRS Management, explained the tree trimming and removal was set to take a total of 3 to 4 weeks. By the end of January, who knows how many trees will be left. Explanations about the tree removal have varied. Stanwyck says he recalls a property manager saying they wanted to, quote, let more sunlight in. That's an explanation several other residents say they have heard, including one anonymous social media user who posted a lengthy protest on Reddit. That resident wrote, I understand needing to cut trees because of danger to property if they fall, roots getting into foundations or into plumbing. That's not what's happening here. They literally told me they want to open it up and make it brighter. So anything with a particular diameter is being cut down. On the other hand, ZRS has also sent emails to residents stating the tree removal is for safety reasons. Another resident who wished to remain anonymous due to fear of retaliation from the management company forwarded this explanation for ZRS. Work is being completed due to the structural damage as the roots and branches are overgrown. As the roots grow, they damage sidewalks, foundations, and underground piping around the community. Also, the overgrown branches are causing damage to the rooftops of the building. We are trying to prevent structural damage to the community and other issues that could cause water intrusions later on. We do apologize that the communication was not sent out when this project started to let residents know. That same resident who's lived in Edwards Mill since 2008 refuted this claim, saying he and his partner have not seen roots breaking up the parking lot or sidewalk, and that most of the trees and branches being cut are healthy. When asked about the tree cutting, ZRS property manager Amelia Wright told Indy she had no comment. In a follow-up email, the regional manager Katie Shane reiterated that sentiment, saying, I am unable to provide you with any comment at this time. The consensus among residents is that they understand the need for tree trimming from time to time, especially of expensive, overhanging, or sick or dead trees, but the kind of clear-cutting that's happening now is unacceptable. 64-year-old Steve Austin, who's lived in Edwards Mill for about 6 years, I'm disgusted. All my animals are gone, all my chipmunks, squirrels, all my birds are gone. It looks like a natural disaster kind of scene. Austin, who is retired, says he spends a lot of time in his front and backyard shadowboxing. His unit is one of the few with an expansive lawn, which was mostly forest up until 2 weeks ago. Austin also does a lot of walking in local parks, so he says he understands that tree maintenance has to be done. If the trees are sick or at risk of falling on his house, by all means remove them, Austin says. If it's something that had to be done, that's one thing. He adds, I mean, some of the trees are leaning in a precarious position to the house. But from what I heard, the original deal when they sold the property was that the trees were supposed to stay. That natural landscape is one of the reasons Austin moved into Edwards Mill in the first place. Now, a lot of the shade is gone. My car was always in the shade, now it's not. My house was nice and cool in the summer, now it won't be. Residents say that the buzz and rattle of chainsaws and chippers have been nonstop in Edwards Mill since early January. It starts as early as 8 a.m. and can last all day, according to some who work from home. It's unclear who made the decision to cut down the trees. The property has changed hands a few times since it was expanded in the 1990s, but no drastic changes happened until it was sold this year to Covenant Capital Group, based in Nashville, Tennessee, according to Wake County Records. The former owner, RK Properties in Florida, sold the 37-acre property for $56.5 million on January the 5th. The new owner also brought on a change in management, with ZRS Properties moving into the leasing office. Tree removal started just 7 days later. Property owners are generally allowed what they like to do what they like within the boundaries of their land, including cutting down trees, says Justin Rametta, a zoning administrator with the city of Raleigh. They are bound by certain rules, including the city's tree conservation ordinance, which took effect in 2005. Essentially, this ordinance requires that 10 to 15% of trees on properties bigger than 2 acres must be preserved when a property is being developed or redeveloped. Since Edwards Mill was built before this law took effect, the owners weren't bound to it, says Rametta, but they may still be bound by other parts of zoning law, which requires natural buffers on the edges of the property. Due to the complaints from residents, the city of Raleigh opened an investigation into the tree cutting on January 18th, which is meant to determine whether the property owner is violating any city codes by cutting down certain trees. If found in violation, the owner could face thousands of dollars in fees, depending on how many trees were illegally removed. An inspection was scheduled for January 24th after this indie went to print. Rametta says, basically, part of that investigation entails looking into whether any of the trees that were moved are required by the city or violated any of the city's tree protection ordinances. There are some protection that apply to trees around the perimeter of the property. Now, these city tree conservation rules are designed to protect the environment by preventing clear-cutting, preserving the tree canopy, and protecting existing mature trees. In addition to preserving animal habitats, protecting trees can prevent stormwater runoff and flooding, a common complaint among city residents. The merits of trees in urban areas have been extensively documented. Not only do they provide shade, potentially lowering utility bills, but they absorb heat and greenhouse gas emissions, reduce noise pollution, and provide habitats for wildlife. As climate change worsens, urban residents have pushed for better environmental protections. The environment was a significant talking point in Raleigh's elections last year when environmentalists Jane Harrison and Mary Black Branch were elected. Even before that election, however, the city council was considering expanding tree protections. And Harrison wrote in an email, "Conservation and policies in Raleigh are woefully inadequate for the development pressures we are facing. It's common to see small properties clear-cut and minimal tree protections for larger developments. We need a real plan to preserve forest cover or it will be lost. We must plant and maintain tree canopy cover if we value the beauty, shade, cooling effects, water filtration, and carbon sequestration that trees provide." The City Council is currently considering expanding tree protection, an initiative that started last year before the elections. The new policy proposes tree conservation requirements for properties under 2 acres, as well as protections for, quote, champion trees, and planting requirements for smaller lots. Harrison wrote, "It has the potential to protect native species to the Piedmont, like oaks, basswoods, and hickories. It's a step in the right direction." Rametta added, "Basically, what the City Council has asked staff to look into is potential ways to reduce the threshold for tree conservation from 2 acres to 1. We're also exploring other ways we may be able to increase tree protections on lots that are even smaller than 1 acre. Tree preservation is just one part of a larger initiative by the city to increase sustainability and take action on climate change," says Rametta. Quote, "We're working with Wake County on a tree canopy study to scientifically determine exactly how much tree canopy exists today and where we might focus on preserving that canopy. The city has adopted a climate action plan. These tree conservation rules are just one small piece of a larger initiative the city has regarding trees in general and environmental health. To Esme Fox, now news from Durham, Seed Swap. Under a banner declaring everyone welcome, a small group of Durhamites gather in the winter cold. The yard in front of the Durham Co-op is a sea of colorful wool hats and scarves. Two big black dogs near the parking lot serve as the greeting committee, while parents shepherd their bundled-up kids, reusable tote bags in tow. A woman in a flowing green skirt says, "I would love to grow spinach, but it just doesn't work for me," she says as she examines the table for her perfect seed fit. This is the Durham Co-op's Seed Swap, where different gardening-focused groups in Durham flaunt a variety of seeds for the taking. Everything from sunflowers to pumpkin seeds to whole garlic bulbs. In exchange, amateur local gardeners donate seeds from their own collections. A small group huddles around a woman in a brown suede coat named Jennifer, animatedly discussing a certain seed she's bought, Jimmy Nardello, an Italian variety of sweet pepper. She generously divulges the secret of growing the vegetable. Patience, at least until the plants fully ripen. "They're good green," she says, "but they're really good red." For people looking for more than Jimmy Nardello, the next picnic table offers a diverse assortment of crops, such as squash, cilantro, and broccoli. All this bounty is thanks to the Digging Durham Seed Library. That's the Durham County Library's Seed Swap Initiative, which celebrates its 10th anniversary this year. The program offers a repository of seeds for borrowing. No library card required. Library goers can check out seeds at 7 library branches, along with a detailed brochure that explains how to care for the seeds, which include heirloom varieties. As a part of the deal, patrons are encouraged to return with a donation for the next growing season. In addition to helping Durhamites level up their personal gardens, the program improves local biodiversity and sustainable food sources. One of the library's most popular features, the program gave out over 8,000 seeds last year. The repository is stocked seasonally, and spring seeds have just come in. Think hardy vegetables that can survive some winter frost, like carrots, kale, radishes. During the rest of the growing season, February to October, the seed library offers other crops like flowers and herbs, while supplies last. Librarian Jess Epstein shares a detailed harvest schedule for different seeds throughout the year, compiled based on hundreds and hundreds of years of knowledge about the local climate. A sign directs people to the Seed Swap's resident experts, Ask a Master Gardener. Now, these master gardeners, part of a program run by the NC State Extension, are required to undergo a rigorous botany training process to earn their title. Lena Davison, a master gardener intern, dressed in head-to-toe marigold yellow, says, "I get a little intimidated because I think there's no way I'm going to remember all of this. But it's a community of people who want to guide you. It's a community of people who enjoy plants." Kat Causey, a certified master gardener of 18 years, nods along. "I come to these events and I learn. I will learn from her. She will learn from me." Across the yard is Sunflower Turning, a new nonprofit fighting food injustice by teaching underserved communities to grow their own food. Their picnic table offers seeds donated by a dollar store to help people jumpstart their gardening journeys. The initiative is run out of the basement of Wendy Padilla with the help of her daughters. "Our whole life is gardening," her daughter says, giggling. Keep Durham Beautiful an affiliate of Keep America Beautiful, is situated by the exit. Wildflower seed mix packets are scattered across the table, and Group Representative Dawn Kaiser recommends sowing those seeds now. The winter cold actually benefits many wildflowers, she explains, ensuring that they'll bloom beautifully in the summertime. As people share the perfect ratio of water and sunlight for growth, or murmur excitedly when they find the seed they've been looking for, Master Gardener Cowsey looks on with pride. This is a true community gem. It engages the public as well as gardening experts. You can't ask for more. 12 minutes left in my time allotted for Indie Week, and I have time to for a conversation with Ibram X. Kendi about how to be a young anti-racist. He's a co-author Nick Stone's adaptation of his best-selling manual, ahead of a Raleigh stop on their book launch tour. Shelby Polk writes this from the arts section of Indie Week. A little over a year after its release, How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram X. Kendi has become an international sensation. In the summer of 2020, protests broke out in the wake of George Floyd's death, and Kendi became a household name in some wildly different circles. How to Be an Anti-Racist was Kendi's third book, and it has since been adapted into a children's book, a journal, and a parent's guide to raising an anti-racist. For the newest version, Kendi handed the reins to Nick Stone, the New York Times best-selling author of several young adult novels, including Dear Martin. Stone took the structure of the original anti-racist and turned it around to tell Kendi his own stories. How to Be a Young Anti-Racist is written with an inviting second-person narration that follows Kendi through many of the early experiences he recounts in the original. Stone also shares some of her experiences as a black queer woman, adding intersections to a young reader's understanding of discrimination. Rofiwa Book Cafe and Quail Ridge Books will host both Kendi and Stone on the fourth of 10 stops of their book launch tour for How to Be a Young Anti-Racist, which comes out very soon on January 31st alongside the paperback edition of the original. The event will be held at Meredith College Jones Auditorium, and the ticket price will include a copy of the book. Ahead of the event, Indie Week spoke to Kendi about the work and collaboration. So this is question and answer. I think the most obvious question, but the one that people are going to need to know, is why are you versioning this book? Well, I think first and foremost, because even kids 12 and up are unfortunately being told there's something better or worse about them, or wrong or right about them because of the color of their skin. Even young people are facing things like police violence, houselessness, or disproportionate amounts of poverty. Teenagers can see and oftentimes experience racism, and so, for them to have clarity about what racism is, and more importantly, what they can do to challenge it, I think is important. I also think a large portion of the personal narrative is actually in some of the most critical moments when I was a teenager, and I think that that's going to be quite enchanting, particularly for teenagers. Tell me about working with Nick Stone. The choice to put it in the second person was really interesting to me. I'm just so excited to be able to work with Nick Stone, and what I was really excited to see was the way in which Nick Stone, I think through her own creativity and brilliance, was literally able to create an entirely new book. Like, this is a completely different experience from it being in first person. The organization of the chapters is pretty radically different, and the voice, obviously. Certainly, this technically is an adaptation, but in many ways it is a completely new book that's rightly geared to teenagers. I have to admit that I didn't read the first version until after it had become so infamous in some circles, and I was shocked by how gentle it is. I love, especially in this young adult version, how inclusive it is of everyone who's trying to do any kind of this work. Were you surprised by how much attention the first version got? We certainly wanted many people to be reading the book and reflecting on themselves and society, but I would never have imagined it would have become like a global bestseller and that people around the world would learn about what it means to be anti-racist. It wasn't even something I could necessarily dream of. I've not spent a lot of time responding to the misrepresentations and misinformation surrounding how to be an anti-racist. And part of the reason is that I feel that whoever takes the time to read the book, they're going to see for themselves that that misinformation was false. What have you heard from parents about how the earlier versions have helped them? What do you hope to hear about this version? I think what I've heard from parents and even teachers is that it allowed them to become much more self-reflective. It allowed them to really begin to think about their own life, their own journey, how they came to believe what they do believe about different racial groups. And similarly, I'm hoping the same thing happens for young people. Our young people, they are deeply introspective. And they obviously, in many cases, aren't as sensitive as we are to being self-critical. So, I actually think in certain types of ways our young people are much more open to understanding their world and understanding themselves, and that's why I'm excited to get this book before them. Are you heartened by the conversations we're having now for high schoolers, middle schoolers, whoever, to be following along with these really serious conversations? I'm heartened that there are. For instance, Nick Stone is part of really a generation of YA authors of different backgrounds who are writing all different types of novels that are relevant to the experiences of so many of our young people. I think I'm just excited about this outpouring of literature in this moment by these incredible authors. We just did not have that when I was a kid, and certainly not when I was in middle and in high school. Of course, the genesis of so many of these conversations is tragedy. It is. And it is tragic, for instance, to know that there are kids like Adam Toledo, 12-year-olds in Chicago, and even Tamir Rice in Cleveland, who were killed as a result of the violence of racism. So I think for us as caregivers, as people who love our children, whether it's children who are being harmed by police violence or even our young white male young people who are being recruited online by white supremacists on multiplayer video games or through direct messages on social media, it's critically important for us to expose them to this literature so that they know they are not the problem. I read in some older interviews that your daughter was 6. Is she in first grade now? She is 6 in first grade. What do your conversations about race look like with her? Mostly, when we're talking about race and racism, typically it happens in one or two areas. Either we're reading a book on it, which allows us to have conversations, or something is happening in my life or her mother's life or in society somewhere, and we see the effects of racism and we show it to her and we explain it to her and we talk to her about it. Sometimes she has questions, sometimes she doesn't. Or in other cases, my partner and I, we're talking about something and she's actually more willing to ask questions because we didn't initiate it. We're always trying to figure out ways to put her in a position that she becomes curious, because typically there'll be much more robust conversations. How are you hoping her schools approach this going forward? I'm hoping that her schools, and really the schools of all our children, realize that one of the most important things we must do for our children is to raise them to be anti-racists and put literature in front of them that helps facilitate that goal. And what it means to be anti-racist for a child is for them to be able to see all the different looking people in their community and not see certain people as better or worse. What it means for a young person is for them to begin to understand that there are bad rules in our society, not bad people. And what it means for our children is for them to understand the history of those rules and the history of this country, and also for them to begin to understand that their culture is different than the cultures of other peoples. But that does not make it better or worse. It's just different. And sort of generates a curiosity for the multiplicity of humanity. We briefly talked about people who intentionally have misused your work. What about parents who mean well? Are there any concerns you have about how, especially, white parents could possibly misuse a book with the best of intentions here? I do think we should not hand How to Be a Young Anti-Racist to a child, a young person, and then say to them, this is all you need to read on the subject. That's one of the reasons why we pair How to Be a Young Anti-Racist with Stamped. If one is the backstory, one is the action plan. So I think it's better for parents to introduce the book as more of an introduction. And then students or young people will continue their reading on other subjects. I'm excited about the fact that the paperback edition of How to Be an Anti-Racist is coming out on the same day, because it gives parents and students and teachers the ability to reread or read for the first time the adult book when their child or their student is reading the younger one. So when that student has questions or when they want to have conversations, older people are more equipped to be able to do so. I think this is the type of book that's just going to spark conversations. And obviously, I think one of the things we tried to convey to young people through the book is that the most important thing, obviously, is asking the question. Well, I got to most of the articles in the print and online Indie Week edition, which surprises me by my excellence. And I'll be hoping for a whopping raise from my superior officers at ncreadingservice.org sometime in the next decade. And I can hear the music coming up, and that's because I'm also pushing the button that makes it come up. John Federson for Indie Week. We'll return in the week for the next weekly edition of this journal, and we appreciate your listening to us. It's available at the podcast section at ncreadingservice.org, and we will let our music carry us to the end of this show of Indie Week. So long for now.